Well, the levels of concentration can happen two ways. One is, as you say, that it just happens to come. That's kind of a natural maturation. And other times you have to be nudged a little bit to have some idea, well, what do I let go of now? Yeah, whatever it is, that's
right. Okay.
It helps to have a little bit of the roadmap, and as I said, you look at the roadmap after you come out, and then you might remember, okay, the next time, let me see if I drop this, if what happens. Because what you're trying to do is get a state of mind that you can keep together with as little effort as possible. And so when you're testing that, sometimes you find, okay, if I let up on the effort, the whole thing falls apart. Okay, can you let go prematurely? So you go back and you try to recreate what you had. John Fuang's example is of, or his analogy is of pouring concrete. You know, you have to wait until the concrete is set before you can take the forms away. Yes?
So it's all a kind of feel as you go on.
Right.
What happens if I make a pull this now?
Mm-hmm.
And it collapses and...
So, well, I've got to go back and reassemble it. I don't want to talk about anybody else's jhana practice. Yes?
Can you talk about labeling in mindfulness?
Okay, labeling is one way of recognizing what's going on. And it has two functions. One is, once you can label something, then you should have an idea what to do with it. Whether it's something to let go, something to maintain. Now, as the labeling practice usually is aimed at whatever comes up that's a distraction, you sort of note it, and then you go back to where you were.
I was thinking of it more as just a technique to, because sometimes I use it to calm myself down, so that because I can't do the breath because there's too much going on in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So then I just watch the body, label it, and it brings me.
Yeah, you can use just about any word you want to label things. As we're calming the mind down, and then you can turn to the breath.
So it's good as like a preliminary?
It's good as a preliminary, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not
no, because it then will prevent you from getting into deeper levels of concentration. Yes?
Do you have a health concern, or like, is it appropriate to use breath?
Oh, very much so. Use the breath if you have some health issues, and see if by allowing the breath energies to go to the parts of the body that are affected, that might help speed up the healing. I think I mentioned to you that John Lee discovered this method as a way of recovering from a heart attack. So we've got some good precedents. Yes.
Can the jhanas practice be used as an escape?
Of course. I'm out of here. I'm closing my mind and I'm just running away.
That's okay.
Well, I'm going to be talking about the uses for jhana in just a second. And one of them is to have a pleasant abiding, a place where the mind can stay. When it gets pathological, is, you know, there's work that has to be done, and you're just hanging out in this pleasant state.
Mine's more, I get really annoyed at anybody who messes with
which brings up issues. You say, well, they're not messing with your jhana. You're messing with your jhana. Okay, let's go on to the next topic, which is the four uses for jhana. There is a tendency among some people to regard the jhana almost as an end in itself. Kind of like the badges you get as a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout. You've got your four jhana badges. Which is not why the Buddha taught it. He said it is meant to be used. It has its purpose. And he lists four different purposes for jhana practice. And the first one is to have a pleasant abiding, another place, a good place where the mind can stay, a place where you feel comfortable, a place where you feel at ease. There's a lot written about the dangers of getting stuck on the pleasure of jhana. But the Buddha actually said it's a necessary part of the practice. It's kind of a food for the mind. It's a nourishment. He gives an analogy of the fortress. And remember, we had the gatekeeper at the gate, and then we had the soldiers of right effort. We have the wall of discernment around the fortress. We have the foundation post of conviction. And then you have the food stores, which are the four jhanas. And this is what keeps the right effort going, keeps your right mindfulness going. So there's a set end. It's an also it's an alternative escape from pain, because usually the way we escape from pain is to go into sensuality, thinking thoughts of sensual pleasures you're missing or sensual pleasures you would like to have. And the Buddha said, if you don't have this pleasure, you're going to go for sensuality, which is a much more dangerous kind of pleasure. People don't kill or steal or wage war over jhana, but they do over sensuality. And also the pleasure of jhana actually makes your virtue and your discernment stronger, because it gives them, as I said, more nourishment. So learning how to use it properly as a pleasant place to stay, as an easeful place to stay for the mind, as you say, it can also be used because of the pleasure that comes in. It can actually be healing for the body, healing for the mind. So that's the first use of jhana. The second one is for psychic powers, which we don't have to go into too much detail on. The use of the psychic powers, and is the best use of them, is to develop sangweka. You have some visions of your previous lifetimes, and you know, if you were a king or a queen, you say, "My gosh, look what happens to the glory of the world. Now I'm born here." And if you can see yourself as having been a leper or a very poor person, you realize, okay, that's happened to me as well. And this could potentially happen again in the future if I'm not careful. When the canon talks about psychic powers, especially those developed by monks, it treats them with a sense of humor. And the reason it does that is to realize, okay, you don't take these things too seriously. And you also have to realize they're dangerous. Don't put too much faith in them. I mean, I've seen people who have psychic powers who turn out to be unreliable in other ways. So just because someone can read your mind or can display a psychic power doesn't mean that they have any sort of goodness as an individual. It's just they've learned the techniques. And it's good to have some guidance in them, because there are people who will develop them, and they need guidance in how to develop them wisely. I'll tell you one story from the canon. There was a monk, a young monk, who was staying with a group of older monks, and he was invited to a meal by Jitta, the householder. Now, Jitta was an exemplary householder. He was a non-returner. And the reason he didn't ordain was because he had his elderly mother he had to take care of, and so he stayed a layperson. But he would invite the monks over to his house every now and then. And so one day they go, and after the meal they're coming back, and it's a hot, humid day. And as I said, the monks were going along as if they were melting. And the youngest monk says to the elder monk, wouldn't it be nice to have a little breeze right now, maybe some clouds and a little sprinkling of rain to cool things down? And the elderly monk says, yeah, that would be very nice. So all of a sudden, the clouds come up, the breeze comes, the rain starts coming down. Well, Jitta's following behind. He sees this. Gosh, this monk has these powers. And so when they get back to the monastery, the younger monk says, is that enough? And the elderly monk says, yes, that's enough. That was very nice of you. And they go back to their huts. So Jitta follows the younger monk to his hut. And he says, I saw that. Can you do anything else? And so the monk says, okay, take off your upper robe. Because back in those days, the lay people wore robes pretty much like the monks do. Simply they had different colors. So they had an upper robe. Take off your upper robe, place it on the porch of his hut. And then he had him put a pile of grass on top of the robe. Then the monk went into the hut, and a minute or so later, all of a sudden, this flame comes out in the cracks between the doors and consumes the grass, but doesn't touch the cloth, and then retreats. And so Jitta's shaking off his robe and his hair standing on end, and the monk comes out and says, is that enough? And Jitta says, that's plenty. And he says, for now, if you have any lack in terms of food, clothing, shelter, or medicine, let me know. I'll be happy to provide it. And the monk says, thank you. That was very nice of you to offer that. And so when Jitta goes away, the monk packs up his stuff and he's gone. Because he realizes once word gets out, he's going to be in trouble. So he better get out of there. But the whole thing is treated as a humorous story. And that helps keep people from getting kind of wild-eyed about, wow, psychic powers are really cool. They're not a guarantee of anything. Okay, that's another use of psychic powers. Another use of jhana. The third use of jhana is to increase your mindfulness and alertness. It's a lot easier to remember things, and it's a lot easier to be alert to what's going on when your mind is still. And this is the distinction between right concentration and wrong concentration. I mean, there are some heavy states of concentration you can get into where you are not mindful of anything, you are not alert of anything. That's wrong concentration for that very reason. You want a state of concentration that is just right, in other words, settled enough to be still so you can see what's going on in the mind, but not so deep that you kind of blank out. And that connects with the fourth use of concentration, which is for the purpose of release, to put an end to defilement. The practice of jhana, on the one hand, as I said, makes you more alert to what's actually going on in the mind, so that when a cause of suffering arises, you can see it, that there's actually stress that's coming up, and you can see what you're doing that's causing the stress. It's right there in front of you. And also, as you're getting the mind into jhana, you are actually getting more and more used to this process of fabrication, if you're looking at it from the right point of view. The three fabrications we talked about yesterday, there's the physical, verbal, and mental. Physical fabrication is the way you intentionally engage in the breathing. Verbal is your directed thought and evaluation. Mental is perceptions and feelings. Well, all these things are present in the jhana. In fact, they go to make up the state of concentration that you're working on. And as you get used to going in and out of the different levels, you begin to see that when you go from the first jhana to the second jhana, that verbal fabrication falls away. You go from the third jhana to the fourth jhana, physical fabrication falls away. You get up into the higher levels of the formless jhanas, ultimately mental fabrication will fall away as well. So you begin to see this is how the mind puts these states together. And once you get used to seeing how it puts it together in the concentration, then you begin to notice how you do it in daily life. Like when an emotion comes up, you can begin to see, oh, this is the element which is bodily fabrication, i.e., say where there's anger, this is how I'm breathing around my anger, maybe I can change the way I breathe. This is how I talk to myself around the anger, maybe I can change the way I talk to myself. These are the images I hold in mind, maybe I can change those images. So the practice of jhana is meant to help you see these things as they're happening. There's also a way of analyzing the jhanas in terms of the five aggregates. And this will be useful as you're trying to get to understand suffering. Again, you're focused on your breath and your mind is settled down, the fact that you've got the form of the body sitting there and there's a sense of the breath energy filling the body, that's the aggregate of form. You've got the feeling of pleasure that you've got filling the body, that's the aggregate of pleasure, that's the aggregate of feeling. There's the perception of the breath that you hold in mind that helps keep you anchored in the breath. There's the directed thought and evaluation that helps you fabricate and adjust the mind as it's settling down. And then there's finally consciousness, which is aware of all these things. So you've got, it's kind of like a laboratory test case for these are the five aggregates. And that's where we begin to move from discernment, concentration practice into discernment practice. Gaining insight into the process of fabrication is going to lie at the basis of gaining the insight that will give you release. Because as I said earlier, the Buddhist picture of the mind is that it is proactive, and it's through this process of fabrication that you're going out and you're actually engaging in the world. The perceptions you're holding in mind, the feelings you're holding in mind, the way you're talking to yourself, this all happens prior to sensory input. And a lot of times this happens just so automatically and so quickly that we just take it for granted. What we're trying to do is get the mind in a position where it can begin to see these processes as they're preparing to shape things, or how they're preparing to go out and look for things out of your sensory, out of the senses. So, any questions on those four uses of concentration? Yes?
As I require to reach the final rule?
Mindfulness and alertness, well, three of those are required. Having a pleasant abiding in the concentration, having mindfulness and alertness, and then putting an end to the defilements. The one that's optional is the psychic powers. Thank goodness. Yes?
Are the psychic powers, from the canon, considered metaphorical, or do they kind of happen still in the monastic community?
I've had experience with my teachers having some powers like that. Number one with the John Furung was the ability to read minds. It was scary. Can you imagine being around someone who can read your mind all the time, anytime? You got to be very careful what you think. John Lee was famous for having mastered all of them except for levitation. And he could make other people levitate. For some reason, he couldn't levitate himself. There's a great story they tell about monks were out on a Tudong in Ayutthaya. This is back in the days when Ayutthaya was still kind of, especially the area around the old palace was still kind of wilderness. It had just kind of grown up. And they had these enormous putsan trees. It's a kind of little tiny, almost like an apple. But they had these huge spreading branches that had off. And so one evening the monks were sitting around in a circle under one of these trees. And Ajahn Phuong, who was maybe about two or three people away from Ajahn Lee, began to notice that the monk next to Ajahn Lee was rising up and going down. And then the next monk, up and down, going around the circle. And Ajahn Phuong decided, okay, he's not going to get me off the ground. And so he thought about earth property, solid, solid, a root going down from the base of his spine down into the ground, you know. And so it gets closer and closer until it's the monk next to him, and he goes, rise up the ground, and comes down. And then Ajahn Phuong said, if I like this push coming from underneath, he goes, oh, no, I'm not going up. And it stopped. And then it was the monk next to him, up, down, went around. And when the meditation was over, Ajahn Lee looked over to Ajahn Phuong and said, stubborn.
What was Ajahn Lee's motivation in dictating other monks?
Just to show that he could do it. I mean, that there's in the canon as well, and sometimes with the other stories about Ajahn Lee around these psychic powers, there's a sense, well, hey, I can do it. Why don't they just, you know, play around with it a little bit? Ajahn Phuong's term for this was, he said, these are the fun and games for meditators. In other words, don't take them too seriously. I mean, we did learn of a case recently. There was this one monk who had really, I mean, amazing psychic powers. He could make himself disappear. He could appear in several places at once. And then it turned out that he was fooling around sexually. Yeah. It was like this total split personality. And then when he's found out, he said, oh yeah, and then disrobed. So, which is why I say you can't totally trust people who have psychic powers. There's no sign of any definite attainment.
Breaks my mind.
I know, but it's... Again, it's... Psychic powers don't necessarily come with wisdom. Is that enough psychic power stories? I could entertain you for the whole rest of the afternoon. Yes?
Can you speak more about the energy pathways?
Okay, they're very similar. The energy pathways in the body are very similar to the ones that you read about, say, in Hindu texts or Tibetan texts, that there are channels and the kind of nodes, like the nodes that Ajahn Lee talks about for places where you can focus your attention and breath energy. Those are very similar to the chakras. But it's what I like about the forest tradition approach to this is, you know, you explore in your own body where you feel the movement of energy and what direction you want to think of it's going for any particular ailment. Because we're not here to breathe perfectly. We're here to breathe well enough so the mind can settle down. And we get a sense of, at least to some extent, sense of how, you know, our sense of the body is not just a given, but it is also something that we fabricate by our present intentions. That's the important insight that you're going to get from this. And at the same time, it helps you sit longer periods of time with less pain. Or when a pain does come up, it gives you a position, place where you can place your mind so you don't have to be enveloped by the pain. That's what we're working on. Yes.
Do we understand correctly that the formless jhanas are not essential, but they are of value to some people?
They are. The formless jhanas do have their value, and the Buddha says you can use them as a basis for awakening just as you can with the other jhanas. Now, there is a distinction, though. There are some ways of getting into the formless jhana, or he never calls them formless jhanas, he just calls them formlessnesses, formless states. And there are ways you can get into them having bypassed the four jhanas. But when you do that, you miss all the insight that you would get into fabrication. I mean, the Buddha himself, as a young practitioner, learned this bypass route, which is why when he was about to get awakened, he had to go back and develop the four jhanas to get that insight into the processes of fabrication that he was going to need for his release. Yes.
You're referring to the pain during the meditation. Is it always related to current sitting and current conditions, or it's maybe something from like past arising?
Okay, you've got a combination of past and present karma. And so the way to test for that is, well, change your intention, change your perception, change the way you breathe, see if that has an effect. And sometimes it was the present, just your lack of skill in the present moment that was creating the pain. Other times it's coming in from past karma, which means, okay, I'm going to have to live with it, but I can learn how not to fabricate suffering around the pain.
That's like a tool to use.
These are like tools to use, yeah. Yes?
When you're dealing with pain, let's say you stub your toe, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's the initial shock. Stubbed your toe.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're directing your mind away from the toe itself.
What you would do is trying to find a spot in the body that's comfortable, where the breathing feels good, and then think of the breath energy going down and out through the stubbed toe. To make sure that you're not going to start tensing up around that stub toe, which would actually add to the more pain than you would actually need to have. And sometimes, okay, the toe is going to continue to throb for a bit, but you can say, at least I have a place where I can place the mind that I'm not having to focus on the pain. I find this really great going to a dentist. You know, all this horrible stuff is happening in your jaw, and it seems very close. So I can just put my attention down to my feet.
Mm.
And so I know the pain is there, but I'm not immersing myself in the pain. Yes?
I have a question about, first of all, there's filling the body with the rapture and pleasure born of concentration, and then the next is pleasure divested of rapture. Is that tied somehow with pitti and sukha?
Yes, the rapture is pitti. Pleasure is sukha.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And as we said, there comes a point where it seems like the energy of the rapture is just a little bit too much. You want something quieter and more refined. So you move down into a new, deeper, more refined level of concentration. Yes?
Does anybody in Buddha's time also practice the jhana, intense or formless attainments?
Excuse me?
So the Buddha is the first one?
No, there are people prior to the Buddha who were doing jhana.
It's kind of lost.
And they were also getting some of the, you know, the ability to see previous lifetimes, that kind of thing. That was a common attainment in those days, or something that was known.
But nobody can teach Buddha.
Nobody taught him. Well, it may have been lost, or maybe it just been kept secret by other people. And he looked back and he could see, oh, there were these other people who had been doing it. Maybe they explained it in a different way. I mean, he was the one who took the fact that it is an example of fabrication and used that as a way of liberating the mind. That was totally new with him. And he found a new use for the jhana. But anyway, he's had his teachers who were teaching the formless jhanas. For some reason, the four jhanas as we know them, that was something he had to rediscover.
Do we have like textual or historical evidence of that?
Well, he simply said that, you know, there are these people who develop the concentration that whereby they can see previous lifetimes, where they can see other things. Mm-hmm. And it requires the fourth jhana. Yes.
When you were talking about the use of the jhana, you mentioned that it was a nice metaphor of fortress
of the mind.
Yes. Can you just say that again?
Okay. You've got a moat and a road around the fortress, and those are your sense of shame and compunction. You've got a foundation post for the fortress, and that's your conviction. You have a plastered wall, which is discernment. The reason you plaster it is so that the enemy cannot get a foothold in the wall. And then you have the wise gatekeeper, which is mindfulness. And you have the soldiers, which are right effort. The soldiers have their weapons, that's discernment. And then you have the stores of food, which are the jhanas. Okay, let's move on to discernment. Okay, the faculty of discernment is expressed in terms of the Four Noble Truths. This discernment builds on conviction and it takes inspiration from the Buddha's awakening, and particularly the third knowledge of his awakening. This is when he was using the Four Noble Truths to reach the deathless, particularly by focus on the problem of suffering. It's interesting that there doesn't seem to be any other teaching in the Buddhist time that focused on suffering as the big issue. They had other issues that they were concerned with, but for the Buddha it was suffering, what we're doing, what suffering is, what's causing it. When we use the Four Noble Truths to focus on our own suffering, in the beginning it's done on faith, because and the faith that this will be a worthwhile place to look. Requires some faith, because the Buddha's analysis of suffering is very counterintuitive. We suffer, he says, in feeding on our sense of what we want and of who we are and how we can get what we want. Now, these are the things that we tend to think of. These are our strategies for finding happiness. Yet the Buddha says, okay, we feed on these things in such a way that we're actually causing suffering. So this goes against the grain. Feeding is so intrinsic to our basic strategy for finding happiness and our sense of what it means to be a being. That is very unsettling to think that maybe the way we're feeding, and feeding here can mean both physical and more primarily emotionally and mentally. So it's going to be hard to uproot. But the conviction and acting on the conviction has put us in a better position to appreciate that maybe changing our feeding habits is possible and advantageous. And we begin to see this approach works in getting rid of our own suffering, then we begin to get a glimpse for ourselves that the Buddha may have been right, that this is the problem. This glimpse isn't really confirmed, though, until the first taste of awakening. So, what are the Four Noble Truths? They're not just four interesting facts about suffering. They're a way of dividing up your experience. And you divide them up in this way because each quadrant that we're going to be looking at has a different duty. There's stress, and then there's the origination of stress. And the word stress I'm translating here is the Pali word is dukkha. It can also be translated as suffering, but there are times in the mind when you've got some dukkha, and it's not really suffering, but there is stress present. There are three reasons for using the translation of stress. One is it's hard to romanticize stress. You have songs and songs and poems about suffering, but I still don't know of a strong boy, I'm stressed out. Secondly, is I had a friend in Bangkok who was a journalist, and he asked me, he said, why is the Buddhism talking about suffering all the time? I don't have any suffering in my life, this is not speaking to me. And he said, do you have any stress? Oh yeah, I'm stressed out like crazy. And he said, okay, that's what we're talking about. And then thirdly, there are, as I said, levels of dukkha in the mind that are stressful that you wouldn't, but they're so subtle that you would not call them suffering. And it's good to notice that even the stress of concentration does count as a form of dukkha that you're going to have to get beyond. So the disadvantage of stress, of course, is that it doesn't really seem to do justice to some of the really heavy, heavy suffering that we have in life. So sometimes I'll translate it as stress and suffering, or stress / suffering. And the Four Noble Truths, in addition to giving us a pattern for understanding what suffering is, how it's caused, the fact that it can be put an end to, and can be put to suffering or stress, and that there's a path of practice, it's kind of a value judgment. If something is going to be causing stress, it better be worth it if you're going to follow through with it. And if it's not giving you any definite advantage, why do you keep going for it? And you begin to see as you get more and more sensitive to the way the different ways in which the mind creates stress, that you find that there are a lot of things you're doing that are not worth it. And you learn, and that's how you learn how to let go. So there's a value judgment inherent in all this. There's also the value judgment is that the problem of stress and suffering is the big problem to solve. You know, people say, well, there are other problems out there. There's problems in society, there's problems, you know, here and there. But the fact that people are taking whatever comes their way and they're turning it into suffering, if you can learn how to train them not to do that, then you've trained, you've basically solved the big problem in people's lives. And John Surratt used to, well, there was one time when he asked a question, a group of us were sitting around and pointed to the mountain across the valley from the monastery. He said, "Is that mountain heavy?" You know, when John asks a question like that, it's a trick question. So nobody dared answer. And so he said, "Well, if you think of picking it up, yes, it will be heavy, but if you don't pick it up, it's not going to be heavy on you." So this is his analogy for it. We pick up these things, and then it weighs us down, and we complain. But if you learn how not to pick them up to begin with, it can be heavy in and of itself, but it's not going to be heavy on you. Once this problem is solved, then there's nothing else that is a problem for the mind. So, you've got these four truths: stress and suffering, its origination, its cessation, and the path of practice. Let's look at these in detail. First, the noble truth of suffering or stress. The word noble truth here, this translation of Arya Satya, the word noble, it's noble in the sense that it is takes a noble approach to the question of suffering. You're there not to push it away, you're there to understand it. And secondly, the word noble, Arya in Pali, can also mean universal. These are truths that are true across the board for everybody. Okay, first off, the truth is not that life is suffering, which you hear so many times. The Buddha said something more specific and much more useful about suffering. He said it, and he starts out by listing examples, and then summarizes all these examples of suffering: aging, illness, and death, being separated from what you love, living with what you don't love, not getting what you want. Then he finally summarizes it all with five clinging aggregates. Okay, that doesn't hit you immediately, but it's important to understand what the aggregates are. To begin with, it's important to understand that each aggregate is an activity, is something you're involved in doing. Even your sense of your form of your body is something you are actively recreating all the time. You know, where is your hand, where are your feet? When you sense the body, you can obliterate your sense of the body pretty easily by thinking about some other thought world, and then you bring it back again when you need it. So there is an activity that's involved in maintaining the sense of the form of the body. Feeling is something you do. Perceiving is something you do. Fabricating thoughts is something you do. Cognizing is something you do. These are all activities. Form, again, as I said, is the body. Feeling is feeling tones. We're not talking about emotions so much here. Emotions would come under fabrication. Feeling here means a feeling of pleasure, feeling of pain, feeling of neither pleasure nor pain. Perceptions are the mental images or labels you apply to things. You know, the post, clock, ceiling, person. Just basically the words or images that we use to identify what something is. Fabrications are your intentional construction of thoughts and emotions. And then finally, consciousness is the receptive part of the mind that receives its knowledge of the senses and of the activities going on in the mind. And the question is, why did the Buddha choose five aggregates and other things that the mind does? And I think the reason why he chose these particular five is because all of them play a role in our activity of feeding. But say, take physical feeding as an example. You've got the form of your body that you're trying to maintain, and you've got the form of the food that you're going to be taking in to eat. You've got the feeling of hunger and the feeling of pleasure that you want to gain by assuaging the hunger. You've got the perception one of what kind of things do you hunger right now. Are you hungry for something salty, or are you hungry for something sweet? What you learn how to identify what your needs are, and then you have to also learn to identify, well, what out there is edible. And this, as children, this is our first exploration of the world. You crawl around, you find something, what do you do with it first thing? Stick it in your mouth. See if it's food. And then you begin to get a sense of the world. Okay, these are things I can eat, and these are things I can't eat. And then your sense of what these foods are and what they can do for you gets more and more sophisticated as you grow older. And then you've got the activity of fabrication. Okay, you don't have any food, you're hungry. What are you going to do? You have to formulate a plan. You have to formulate an intention to find the food. once you found the food, sometimes the food is inedible when it's raw, but you can fix it. That too is a kind of fabrication. You know, Julia Child is all fabrication. You know? And then there's consciousness, which is the more passive part of the mind, which receives knowledge of all these things. And all of these things are involved in the activity of feeding, which is why they are so essential to our sense of who we are, because we do tend to identify ourselves around what we feed on. Again, physically and emotionally. I mean, you look at personal ads, and people will define, this is the kind of person I want to feed on. This is who I am. These are things I like to eat. You know, long walks in the evening, sitting by the fireplace. That's the kind of food for the mind. Now, it's the aggregates are activities that are involved in feeling. And they're the raw material. Let me back up a bit. Sometimes we see that the aggregates are the Buddha's definition of what we are. He never defines us as to what we are. In fact, he says that you have to see that the five aggregates are not what you are. They're the things that you use to create your sense of self, the kind of the raw material from which our sense of self is constructed, it is made into a fabrication. But they themselves do not constitute what we are. You can search the whole Pali Canon and you can never find a place where the Buddha answers the question of what is a human being or what you are. You will find a place that says if you try to define yourself, you're going to limit yourself. And so he says, don't limit yourself this way. So we're feeding, we use the aggregates to feed, and we also, clinging itself is an activity, and is also a type of feeding. So this means we have a double layer of feeding going on here. We cling to our potentials from past karma. We cling to the act of actualizing those potentials. And we cling to the results that we anticipate. It's kind of like fixing food. We have the ingredients in our refrigerator, okay? We hold on to those. And then we turn those ingredients into food that we can eat. And we cling to our particular ways of fixing the food. And then we are anticipating, okay, this is going to be really good when I'm done. So these are the things, levels in which we cling. So you have to think of suffering as an active verb. We're engaged in this all the time. We're not just passive recipients of suffering that is imposed on us. It's an activity that we're actually doing. Now, this is going to be important because it is something we are doing, we can stop doing it. I mean, the world can throw all kinds of horrible stuff at us, but if we learn how not to make suffering out of it, we're not going to suffer. So that's why this is a good skill then. Now, for most of us, we're doing all these processes in ignorance, and often it's because of a result of a bad judgment that we're going to suffer. We tend to be really bad judges of what we're doing and the results that we're getting. So so much of the practice, this is why mindfulness is, your practice of mindfulness teaches you to be alert to what are you doing. The practice of concentration teaches you to be alert to what are you doing right now. So getting more and more knowledge to this process. As for our bad value judgment, you drive to Las Vegas. And the reason I know about this is because I go to Zion National Park quite a lot, and if you're going to go from San Diego to Zion, you got to go through Vegas. And you see these billboards that say, our casino has a 93% payback rate. And what are they saying? You know, give us a dollar, we'll give you 93 cents. On average. And people still go. You know? Saturday night, it's just, you know, the highways from LA up to Vegas are packed. You know? So we tend to be pretty bad judges of what's going to be worth it or what's not. Now, the insight for the purpose of release requires not that we stop judging, but because we develop the better powers of judgment as to what's worth doing and what's not. And this is what the Four Noble Truths teach us. We've been doing this activity of suffering, and it's not worth it. We've been engaging in the cause of suffering, and it's not worth it. If we did engage in the path, okay, that would be an effort. It would require some stress, it would require some suffering, but it leads to something that's worth it. So we're engaging in a value judgment. An analogy for our relationship to the aggregates, you can think of, we think we're going to get food from some chickens, we're going to get their eggs. So we feed the chickens. but that we lack the discernment, and so anything that comes out of the chicken, we eat. Get some eggs. On average, however. And on top of that, they're the chickens from hell at night when they come up and they peck at our ears and our eyes. And there was, we said we feed off the aggregates, but the Buddha says the aggregates come back and they chew on us. But by the fact that we're holding on to them, we're feeding them, and we don't see the connection. We think, well, where do these mysterious chickens come from? They're not the same chickens I was feeding during the day. But it turns out that they are. Insight is what's going to help us see the connection. Okay, I'm feeding on this, but this is kind of coming back and giving me problems. And it's also important to notice here that clinging in and of itself is suffering. Sometimes we're told, well, if you cling to things that are impermanent, of course they're going to disappoint you. You're clinging because you think that they're permanent when they're not. But that's not the case. The Buddha says anything you cling to, even if you try to cling to the deathless, there's going to be suffering. So the activity in and of itself is the suffering. Simply being in a position where we have to feed is pretty miserable, even if we're feeding on chicken eggs. If we're careful about it, but still there's going to be some suffering there. So that's basically what suffering, the truth of suffering is. It's suffering is an activity, it's clinging / feeding. And it's something that we're doing. We're doing it because it's based on a bad value judgment as to what's worth doing and what's not. So we have to learn how to see that, see through that, and develop a better course of action. Are there any questions on that first noble truth? Yes. Okay. Different analogy. Well, the idea the Buddha's basic statement is we're feeding off the aggregates, but then the aggregates turn around and chew on us. So, do you want a dog? Okay, well, let's say you really like to fantasize. You're really into the aggregate of fabrication. Okay, and when it gets going, you start feeding off of whatever your mind fabricates. You take your mind's fabrications very seriously. And then it starts fabricating some really bad stuff that makes you suffer. That's the chickens coming in and pecking at you at night, yes. But the analogy also works in terms of whatever comes out of the chicken, I'm going to eat.
I'm not quite
with you there. Well, I can think of two things that come out of chickens. Again, it's the same sort of thing. You take your emotions really seriously, and then you're going to have some really bad emotions, but you're just going to gobble them down anyhow. Okay. No, I guess I'm too much in love with that analogy. Yes. Your intentional putting together of thoughts and internal conversations, attitudes, intentions, those things. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You are saying there are three parts, the clinging to the potential of paskama, clinging to the actualization of paskama, and what's the third?
The anticipation of what you're going to get when you put these things together.
And you were using a like a recipe.
Right, you've got the raw ingredients.
Raw ingredients.
That's the potential from the past. Your skill as a cook. You hold on, you're very attached to your particular skills. And then finally there's the anticipated results. We cling to those as well. I'm doing this for the sake of that, and I really want that very much. Yeah, the fact that you're trying to find some satisfaction out of these things, in other words, you're feeding off of that particular process. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is this what we're to become disenchanted with?
Ultimately, yes. Now, we will find as we get into the Fourth Noble Truth that there's a certain amount of fabrication that goes into that, and in fact, all the aggregates are involved in the path. And so you have to say, okay, these activities, the stress is worth it for the time being. There will be stress, there will be some clinging. One thing I haven't mentioned so far is the different types of clinging the Buddha talks about. I guess I should mention that before we drop this and move on. He says that basically there are four. There's clinging to sensuality, and that's just our fascination with planning sensual pleasures. There's clinging to habits and practices. And this is the way it's done. I'm always going to do it the way it's done. An example I love to give in Thailand is this old guy who ordained very late in life. And he sees his ajahn every morning when the ajahn goes out for his alms roll. The ajahn puts his bowl up to the sky and looks inside and goes down, puts it down. And so the old man lifts his bowl up, picks it down. And then after a while they ask him, why are you putting your bowl up to the sky like that? He says, I don't know, I saw the ajahn do it. So they go ask the ajahn, and ajahn, so I'm checking to see if there's a hole in the bowl. So a lot of us are like the old man. Someone else is doing it, I'll do it, you know. That's the clinging to habits and practices. The third one is clinging to views, specifically views about the world. Like you say, you know, I believe only in a material world. I don't believe in the stuff about consciousness, unless it's a side effect of material things. That would be a clinging to a view. And then finally, the clings to doctrines of the self. In other words, your definition, how you define yourself as a person. Are you your body? Are you the thinker? Are you the awareness? Are you a cosmic self that contains these things? All of this would be have a particular view of yourself that you'd be clinging to. Ultimately, all abandoned. Now, as part of the path, sometimes you will hold on to certain things. Of these four forms of clinging, actually three of them count as can be used on the path. Clinging to a particular habit, you could make the habits of the precepts. Clinging to a particular view, this would be a view about what is right view and what is wrong view, the power of action. Clinging to a sense of yourself as being competent to do this and being responsible, and that you will benefit from this. You will hold on to those three things. There is no role for clinging to sensuality.
Will you judge, basically?
What?
Will you judge what you have to
do? It's a value judgment, again. Just keep remembering this. We're not so much here to figure out what is the true nature of reality. We're here to see what's worth doing. Now, certain views of reality will help us judge as to what's worth doing, but the ultimate question is this worth doing? And there are times when certain forms of clinging will be worth doing because they help develop the path. And then when the path is developed, like the image of the raft, okay, then we're done with it. We can let it go. Yes?
You talked about feeding on the aggregates. Well, if you don't feed on them, what you do, it's almost like we're compelled to feed on them.
Okay, well, this is one of the reasons why you become a good cook of jhana. You learn how to take the aggregates and instead of turning them into, you know, junk food, you turn them into really good food for the path. Remember the analogy we had for the jhana being the stores of food for the fortress? Okay, you learn how to make jhana.
Using the aggregates.
Yeah, using the aggregates. And again, that will be the food that you will feed on as you're learning how to let go of other ways of feeding. And then when it finally delivers you to awakening, to nirvana, that's the place where you don't have to feed anymore. That's why we stop feeding, not so much because we say, I don't want to feed anymore because feeding is in constant stressful in that self. you finally reach some place where there's no need.
Is there a place where you can don't jhanas?
Where you can what?
Don't jhanas. You don't have like jhani practice.
How to learn?
Yeah.
Well, the guided meditation I gave you yesterday is how you start.
So it's basically a path to jhana.
Yes, it's a path to jhana, yeah.
Are both the non-returner and the stream enter, do you have to abandon all clinging to achieve either of those states?
You let go momentarily.
Momentarily.
Yeah.
But you still have some of it.
You have the potential that will carry on, yeah. Mm-hmm. But to gain any of the levels of awakening, it has to be a momentary dropping. It's only the arahant is finally done. Okay, let's move on to the origination of suffering, which the Buddha identifies as three kinds of clinging, clinging to sensuality, to becoming, and non-becoming. Now notice, not all desire is bad for the purpose of release. As we've seen in the discussion of persistence yesterday, that there is that you generate desire to act skillfully and abandon unskillful behavior. So that kind of desire is part of the path. The three kinds of craving for sensuality, in other words, wanting to have more and more and more thinking about sensual thoughts. Craving for becoming, it means to take on a particular identity in a particular world of experience. And then craving for non-becoming is you don't like the identity you've got and you want to destroy it. All three of these kinds of craving will cause us to cling to the aggregates one way or another. That's why they cause suffering. The cessation of suffering is develop dispassion for the cravings. And then the fourth noble truth, which is the path to the cessation of suffering, is basically everything from right view through right concentration, you know, comprising virtue, concentration, and discernment. Now the reason we have these four noble truths is because each one has a different duty. Comprehend suffering, abandon craving, realize cessation, and develop the path. Now those first three duties revolve around dispassion. To comprehend suffering means you understand at the point where you no longer have any passion for it. Craving, your bent or abandoned craving will require dispassion for craving. Third noble truth is actually the fact where you are developing dispassion for the craving. Notice you're attacking the problem at the cause and not at the effect. In other words, you're trying to abandon that craving. It's like going into a house full of smoke. And if you try to put out the smoke, it's not going to stop. You got to find the fire. You put out the fire, then the smoke ends on its own. So you're looking for the cause. The fourth duty for the path, however, does require some passion in order to create states of concentration, in order to be mindful, in order to engage in right effort and all the other factors of the path, you have to have a certain passion for these things. Which means you're going to be needing to feed in the course of the practice, as we said before, because after all you can't say, gee, my food is impermanent and my stomach is impermanent, so I'll just stop. Because you're going to be hungry. You need to strengthen the mind until it's in a position where it no longer needs to feed. And John Cha has an analogy. He says, you're going to the market, you bought a banana, you come back, someone asks you, what are you going to do with the banana? You say, I'm going to eat it. And then they ask you, are you going to eat the peel? No. Why are you carrying the peel? He says, well, what are you going to answer them? And he says, it's interesting, his answer to this comes in two stages. The first is, you're going to answer with desire. In other words, you have to desire to come up with a good answer. It's not just going to occur to you. And then, of course, the desire is, then the right answer is, the time hasn't come to let go of the peel yet. If I let go of the peel now, the banana becomes mush in my hands. So there will come a point where I let go of the peel, but not yet. Yeah. In the same way with the path. There are certain things you have to hold on to. You can't let go of them too early. You have to hold on to the practice of concentration, the practice of virtue, and so on. Otherwise, your mind becomes mush. Okay. all these activities, we have to make a value judgment as to, is it worth doing? And in the path, there are certain things you have to cling to. You say, it's still worth clinging to these things. But you have to see everything else that would get in the way of the path is something you want to let go. So notice that this is following through the Buddha's duty as a teacher, is giving us a sense of what should and should not be done. The cause of suffering is something that should not be done. Suffering itself is something that should not be done. The path is something we should do. So again, this dichotomy comes all the way through the path practice. Notice that so far we've been talking about discernment in terms of the Four Noble Truths, and we're not talking that much about the three characteristics. There is a tendency in the commentaries to make the three characteristics more important than the Four Noble Truths, but I think this is a distortion of the Buddhist teachings. Because the three characteristics on their own do not carry any duties. We talked about this yesterday, the idea that life is short, so eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow you may die. I mean, that's one reaction to impermanence. So, what is the Buddha's take on that? He says, well, the three characteristics are best understood, one, not as characteristics, but as perceptions. The Buddha never uses the word three characteristics anywhere in the canon. He refers to these things as perceptions, and the perception of inconstancy, the perception of stress in things that are inconstant, and the perception of not-self for things that are inconstant and stressful. They have their role in helping us perform the duties of the Four Noble Truths. All of these perceptions are meant to give rise to a sense of dispassion. For example, when you're practicing the precepts, you don't think about, gee, my precepts are inconstant, and just leave it at that. You're fighting against that. You apply these perceptions to things that would pull you away from the precepts. Like the Buddha says, if you're afraid that you're going to lose your wealth by not lying, or you're going to lose your relatives by not lying, or you're going to lose your health by not lying, he says, remember, there's wealth, relatives, health, those things are going to be inconstant. And then the impact of having lied was going to be much more long-lasting. So you apply those perceptions to the things that would pull you off the path. The same way in the practice of concentration, anything that would act as a distraction, okay, you apply these three perceptions to those things. You sit there fantasizing, having a Vipassana romance on a retreat. You have to realize, okay, this person is in constant stressful, not self. My fantasies are in constant stressful, not self. I've got to work on my concentration so I have something more reliable. And as you're doing the concentration, you're actually fighting against those three characteristics. You're trying to create a state of mind that is constant and easeful and under your control. Now, there ultimately will come a point where the concentration itself is something you have to look at in terms of these three perceptions. But don't do that until you've actually developed it. And you're never going to learn the truth of inconstancy unless you push against it until you see where it starts pushing back.
Sorry, could you mention
the perception. One is anything that's fabricated is inconstant. Everything that is inconstant is stressful. And everything that is inconstant and stressful is not worth calling yourself. It should be seen as not self. Again, that's a value judgment. The Buddha always comes to the conclusion there is no self. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. But let's say, if something is inconstant and stressful, is it worth saying it's mine? Is it that it's me? For one thing, if you can see something arising and passing away, it's obviously not you. I mean, you're there to watch it come and go. Another question, it's like you're in a shipwreck, and there are things that are passing by, and you see certain things are sinking. Is this worth holding on to? No, I don't think you've ever held on to it. You hold on to something that floats, and you hold on to that until it gets you to the shore, then you let it go. So the path is something that the path floats. It's like Ivory soap, Or are you too young for that commercial? So the past
99.something%
pure, right? Yeah. The things we were subjected to as children. Good grief. So any questions on what we've done so far? Yes.
It was interesting a little bit what we're talking about, because I'm trying to think of how to work with this as much in my daily life and not just the sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I like a little bit about how do we deal with these fabrications that we're just inundated with. And my sense a little bit is how to find, I like the idea of the peel around the mushiness,
mm-hmm.
and what could support us in a way that directs something that would help us in our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I find, because I work as a counselor, is I really try to help people to find inside of themselves something good, something that is the foundation that holds them while they're inundated with stress and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you have any thoughts about just how we can do that.
Well, in terms of daily life, you know, you can hold to the practice of generosity, you can hold to the practice of virtue. And particularly people who are having a lot of problems just sort of getting themselves together, it's good to point out to them there are areas where they can be generous. So it's not just, you know, I need the world to help support me, I need the world to help support me. I can actually help provide some support for the world. That gives them a good solid foundation for self-esteem. Much better than, you know, 5 gold stars on your paper and rock star, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then virtue. Remind yourself, okay, there's certain principles that I can hold to. And even though I may suffer some financial disadvantages because I'm not lying the way everybody else is lying, at least I have something inside me. So I have something inside me that's worth more than any amount of money. I have a student who's a therapist whose job is basically to work with actors and actresses. And she says the number one thing you've got to work with these people is you've got to maintain your moral compass. That just because you're famous doesn't mean all of a sudden that doesn't count anymore. And I think that applies for all levels of society. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these are the things you hold on to. Yes.
I have a question regarding why is the Western world, and maybe even Asia, I don't know, they like so much the Vipassana or insight meditation?
Because, well, one, it was the first meditation technique that was brought over. And it is offered in retreat centers as opposed to monasteries. So a lot of people find it much more approachable that way. I mean, I was trained in the forest tradition, which in terms of Thai cultures, Thai ceremonies and rituals and that kind of thing is really stripped down. But you bring it over here to San Diego and all people can say, wow, Thailand, you know, bowing, chanting, you know. They say, well, yeah, that's some things we don't let go of. Whereas you can go to Vipassana Center and you can go show up in your sweatpants. And the teacher shows up in his or her sweatpants and everything is very casual. And it feels like it's kind of been stripped away from any, you have no commitment to any particular worldview. You say this is a technique that you can apply to anybody. No matter what worldview you're coming from, you can practice the technique. So that's a lot of the appeal. Now the question is, has too much been stripped away? I would say yes, but for some people it's the only way they're going to start approaching the practice. Excuse me? Hmm?
Do your monastery offer residential retreats where you can stay and learn practice?
Do you, at your monastery? monastery? Do you offer?
Oh yes, we have people can come and stay as guests. Yeah, okay.
They're not retreats.
They're not organized retreats. It's just kind of living in part of the monastery life.
But not formal teaching.
Well, there's formal teaching every day. I give a record number of Dharma talks per year, you know. They're short, you know, they're short, 10 minutes, but it's there's a lot of them. Okay.
Could you talk about the causal connections from craving to clinging, and in particular the most opportune moments for unwinding?
Okay, to go from craving to clinging, remember the three kinds of craving, sensuality, becoming, and not becoming. Okay, the connection between sensual craving and sensual clinging is pretty obvious. The word for craving in Pali can also be translated as thirst. The word for clinging in Pali can also be translated as the act of feeding. And you can see how being thirsty or hungry will lead you to feed. In terms of craving for becoming, that will you'll have an idea of, okay, what kind of person do I want to be in what kind of world in order to get what I desire. So you will have certain views about the world, and that will be a clinging to that view, clinging to a doctrine of the self. For craving for a non-becoming is, if you want to see something destroyed, again, there's going to be a view about what would be the destruction of this world that I'm in that I don't like, or the destruction of this identity I have that I don't like, you hold on to a view. Which is why it seems kind of counterintuitive that the craving for non-becoming would actually create more becoming. But it does lead you to cling to certain views, certain ideas of yourself, or certain practices that you might get involved with. And cutting through the connection between craving and clinging, it's best to see the things that you're craving are not really worth it. And this means you have to be, and this is what was going to be the topic of the next period after the break, which is to see that there are certain things you're going for, but it's not worth it. And you have to become sensitive. Well, what am I doing in order to get the result that I want? All too often we're not paying much attention to what we're doing. We're just focusing on the result. And we tend to miss a lot of the unnecessary things that we're doing, or the stress of what we're doing, or the damage of what we're doing as we focus on what we want. So it's just learning how to turn around and look at yourself. This is why the practice of alertness, which is part of mindfulness and concentration, is such an important part of gaining discernment. To continue the analogy with the knives in the drawer, although if we just reach for whatever and cut whatever with whatever, and miss the fact that sometimes we're tossing knives around while we're trying to find the knife that we want, and cutting ourselves on the knives, because we're so focused on what we want to do that we're missing the damage that we're doing. It can work either way, either by focusing on the craving as not really worth it, or the clinging. So this is what I'm getting when I focus on doing X. This is what I'm getting as a result. I'm feeding the chickens, but I'm getting chicken shit. Yeah. There's something wrong. Let's go back and look at the drawbacks of the chicken dung. Or go back and look and say, well, there must be something wrong with the way I'm feeding the chickens. Maybe I'm feeding the wrong chickens, feeding them the wrong thing. It can work either way.
Thank you,
then. It's Sunday afternoon. I got to do something vivid, otherwise everybody's going to drift off. You know? talking to you for 2 days now. Yes.
Maybe you're going to move on to this, but I was just wanting the context about the duties and associated with each noble truth. And so, is that something you practice in meditation as investigation? Is that something that comes after you've developed jhanas?
Well, when you're beginning the practice, the simple fact that you are developing, trying to develop concentration, you're already engaged in one of the duties. So these are skillful mental states that I'm trying to develop. You see anything that's coming up that's getting in the way of the concentration, okay, that's going to be one of the causes of suffering, or it could be the clinging. I've got to learn how to abandon the craving for that kind of distraction. Like there's certain thoughts that will pull you away. So, well, why does this thought pull me away? What's the allure? This is what we're going to get into later. But you're already engaged kind of willy-nilly in these.
Going through each, this is suffering, and then, where is the origin of suffering, not necessarily trying to...
Well, when you're starting to get more sensitive to the activities of the mind, then you have to sort of begin to parse out, okay, which is the suffering and which is the craving? So you know what to abandon. There's a great story about Chokun Noh, who was a meditation monk in Bangkok years ago. And he was doing walking meditation in front of his hut one night. And this young monk in the monastery comes up and says, I can't help myself, I've got these thoughts that I've been obsessing with all day long and I can't get rid of them, I don't know what to do. And Chokun Noh says, well, you're doing the wrong duty. He walked into his hut, shut the door. He was that kind of monk. And so fortunately the young monk had been studying enough so he realized, oh, the duties of the Four Noble Truths. Here I've been developing this thinking where I should be learning how to abandon it or to comprehend the suffering that goes around it. So that's the point where you start thinking in terms of these duties of the Four Noble Truths. But it's especially important when you're dealing with any kind of suffering to realize, I can't just push this away. And then you're trying to abandon the suffering, which you can't do. You look around, either I've got to comprehend the suffering before I can see what's causing it, then I can abandon the cause. That's when the application of the duties gets more precise. Okay, shall we break for a minute, for 30 minutes? Let's come back here a little bit before 3. And then we'll have our final session.